Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered. It is our monthly interview series where I get to sit down with the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry. Today, I am very, very pleased to be joined by David Brevik, co-creator, or just really just creator of Diablo. Yes. This is all you. No one else was involved. One of the creators of Diablo. You've got Hellgate London on your resume. You've got Marvel Heroes on your resume. And you've got a new project at your new one-man studio, Greybeard yes. Games, called It Lurks Below. We'll get to all of that. Thanks so much for coming over.
Well, thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah, it's a thrill for me, as you're going to find out real soon. I am a major Diablo fan, so I'm going to fanboy out on you for about an hour or so, if that's
great.
Okay.
Sounds fun.
I did want to start, though, by wishing you a happy birthday.
Oh, wow.
It's coming up, and up as we record. It'll have happened by the time this airs, but yeah, it's
big one.
It is. It's 5-0?
5-0.
Yeah.
5-0.
Yeah, it's you're just getting started. That's like the new 20.
Well,
right?
I'm not stopping at least.
No, please don't. So you got your start working in the games industry, if I have my crack research correct, by working on Arrow the Acrobat.
Well, sort of. That is true and not true. That's the first game that actually got published.
Okay.
But I was working at a clip art company. I don't remember if you guys even remember what this is, but they would have artists draw little pictures, and they would put all of these pictures on a CD-ROM and sell these things for newsletters and graphics for presentations and stuff. And the company wasn't doing well financially, and they knew the Tramiels, who owned Atari at the time, and so they got this contract to do a video game. And so they hired me as the programmer. I was fresh out of college, and That is where I met Max and Eric Schaefer, and that's how we, originally met.
Who would co-found Condor, which became Blizzard North,
right, exactly,
which we'll get to.
Exactly. So we worked on this, and in fact, somebody just recently on Twitter had mentioned that they found this game. It was called Gordo 106, the Mutant Lab Monkey, and it was on the Atari Lynx.
What a name!
Yeah, and and I worked on it for maybe 5-6 months, something like that, and then my paychecks started bouncing, so I I was like, I gotta rent that I have to make or whatever. So that's when I left or whatever. So I never finished the product, but I coded the first few months of the project. But that was the first thing that I worked on. And it actually eventually did get published. It did actually make it to completion, and some people were playing, because it's an extremely hard game. It's ridiculous, and some people were playing as kind of as a joke game.
It shipped for the Lynx, did you say?
Yeah,
the
exactly.
Man, I had a Lynx, and I just all the
that
thing
system
I remember,
was amazing.
Yeah, it was, but it also, I mean, every handheld back then chewed through batteries, double A's, like in minutes.
Yeah,
well, it was like long.
It was almost like a kind of mini skateboard size. Yeah. It was really big, but it had a beautiful screen, and it had all of these incredible graphic features that you could control a lot of the ways that the graphics were on every single pixel line and things like that that were way ahead of its time. Yeah. And so in that, this was competing with Game Boy. you know, at the time. So it was color. It was way, way better than anything else out there.
Yeah. So then we move to Sunsoft and Arrow the Acrobat.
Yes. Yeah.
So Arrow the Acrobat, for those of you who are not old like me, it was a 1993 Sega Genesis platformer. Again, by Sunsoft, that it has somehow, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, it has somehow stayed. It's been remembered. It has not been forgotten. Because it was back in a time when platformers were like the genre du jour.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You could say
everybody was making. That's all they were making.
Right. That was it. So what was it like working on a character platformer where you were a bat? An acrobat. What was the experience of that game?
It was a pretty crazy time. I was working at Iguana Entertainment. That was the developer who eventually went on to
NBA
make
Jam
NBA
Jam for
Jam.
Home Con. Yeah.
I've got a great story, but we can talk about that
please.
In a second.
Yeah.
So we made Arrow the Acrobat, and I also had, right before this, I had done a football game called Super High Impact Football on the Sega Genesis, which was a conversion from an arcade machine to a console. It was kind of like football version of NBA Jam, right?
Okay. And, pre-blitz.
But the Arrow the Acrobat was this kind of creation by Sunsoft, and David Siller was the person that was kind of behind all this, the person at Sunsoft, and he came up with this character. And we worked on this for a long time or whatever, and it took a lot longer than we thought it was going to take. We had all sorts of tools and all sorts of stuff. I mean, the game is incredibly difficult. And so I think that's one of the reasons that people remember it, really, is because it was like this incredibly difficult platform with really twitchy controls. And we became really good at it in the office. It was one of the first lessons that I learned was, you know, you can become really good at your own video game and then nobody else can play it because you've practiced and practiced and practiced for months and then people pick it up and they're like, I don't even know what to do here. So that's it. Anyway, it's amazing that game continues today to come up. I just came up the other day. Somebody was talking about it. So.
I'm curious, did rivalries with developers of other character platformers happen back then, or is that just like a something I'm imagining in my head and you're all just working?
Well, I mean, I think that there definitely was a, you know, platformer wars or whatever. Everybody had to have their character. Everybody was making a platformer, so how are you going to differentiate yourself from the crowd? And, you know, with the Arrow the Acrobat, you could do all these acrobatic moves, which was really, you know, what kind of set it apart from other games. You could kind of fly and spin and kind of go to the different, you know, make your way up into the sky and different platforms way up in the air and things like that that kind of separated it from the pack of the and like you said, everything was a platformer pretty much back then.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, Iguana and NBA Jam. I don't have any NBA Jam questions because I thought you left before that project, but I'm curious to hear this NBA Jam story.
So we had done this. I had done this Super High Impact Football game.
Yeah.
And Acclaim was the publisher, and Iguana was the developer.
Right.
And so this project, I did this project. I converted the arcade machine to a console, and I did it in 3 months. And this was the first project that Acclaim had had in a long time that was on time and on budget. And so they're like, we got to get you guys some more work or whatever. And you guys did such a great job converting this arcade machine. We should get you, you know, we've got other deals like this in mind or whatever. So let's, at the time, here in California, the place to play arcade machines was this golf land in Sunnyvale. And so a lot of games would premiere there.
Interesting.
And so we went down to the Sunnyvale golf land, and I went with the president, and we went down there, and he said, okay, we're going to go check out this new game. They might want to give us this contract. We're going to go play it, see if we like it or whatever.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, sounds great. We'll go play it, and we'll see what we think. And so we went down there, and we played it, and I was like, oh, my God, this game is going to be a big hit. Or whatever. I think that this is just weird and amazing. And
Everybody loves NBA Jam.
Everybody's going to be. Well, it was an NBA Jam.
Oh, no.
But anyway, so I said, we should definitely do this project.
Okay.
And he said, I don't know this game. I don't know. It's kind of silly. I don't think that we're going to do that. So we turned down Mortal Kombat.
Whoops.
So I almost was the programmer on the Mortal Kombat versions of the console versions of the from, you know, converting it to the from arcade to console.
Yeah.
Anyway, so a few months later, then they, you know, they came back to us and said, "Well, you know, we're sorry that didn't work out, you know." And then, and then it said, "Why don't you go down? We got another game." And so we went down there and I played that. This is also going to be a big hit. We shouldn't turn this one down. He's okay. I believe you this time. And that was NBA Jam. So we end up doing the contract. And when we just right after we signed that, then he got married and moved the company to Texas, and I didn't feel like moving to Texas, and so I kind of was there at the very beginning of the project, but I didn't see it all the way through.
Okay.
And then after I left there, that's where I had called Max and Eric. I know a couple artists or whatever from this. I'm going to call those guys up and see if they're busy and if they want to make a development studio.
Yeah, and that's we'll get to that in a second. I am curious. I'm going to follow this for one more minute. Even though you didn't finish the NBA Jam console project, I remember NBA Jam and the arcade as being like really technologically super impressive. So I don't know if you're a programmer, you would have a much more analytical view of it. Did you look, when you looked at that game, were you like, oh my God, I don't know how I would get this onto a Sega Genesis or Super NES? Or did you look at it and go, yeah, that'll be great, let's do it?
Yeah, I don't think that there was ever any hesitation about it, the technical issues or whatever. The only game that ever really happened to me where I was like, oh, I can't figure this out, this is amazing. The first game, I guess, that really happened to was... it was maybe either Wolfenstein or Doom. Those blew me away,
yeah.
Right? Like, and so that was the first time I stopped and I go, I have no idea how they're doing that.
Right,
and,
it's Carmack. It's John Carmack.
Exactly. and it was an amazing, amazing technology leap that had happened when those premiered.
So what, you mentioned, you know, you came right out of college onto the Atari game, but so what age did you get into video games?
Let's see, it's probably, I had a Pong machine. So I don't. That was 1974 or so, somewhere right in there. And then I had Atari 2600, and so I had always been into video games, and especially once I had the Atari 2600, you know, I fell in love.
That was it
and,
for you.
That was it for me. And then probably 1978, 1979, somewhere right in there, my dad brought home an Apple II Plus from work. And so that was love at first sight, and I pretty much spent the rest of my childhood in front of the Apple II Plus, teaching myself how to program.
That's awesome.
In BASIC, and I did it by there were a lot of kind of magazines at the time that would print entire listings of games or things like that, and I had no money. I was a kid or whatever, so I could afford a magazine. So I would buy the magazine. And I would go home and touch type the program in, and there were a lot of times they were filled with just like pages of numbers that you would have to press in because all the data was just like 293, 253, you know 17. And so you're like, I'm typing in all these numbers, and inevitably you make mistakes or whatever. And so it was also, so I became a really good not only programmer from this, but also a really good debugger because I, in order to get the thing to work, I had to make sure that I had gone through and typed everything exactly. And oftentimes, the listings would have bugs in them and things like that that weren't even printed, weren't even in the article. So, through that, I taught myself how to program and eventually taught myself assembly language. And then after that, then it was I spent so much time in high school making my own games and improving my craft and whatnot.
So you knew what you wanted to be when you grew up from a relatively early age.
Well,
then.
Actually, one of the things that happened was that in the early '80s, Ultima came out, and there was a article in of all things the National Enquirer. About how Richard Garriott had made $100,000.
He told that story in here.
Yeah, making Ultima. And I was like, oh my God, you can make money making video games? That's what I want to do. And then once I knew that that's what I wanted to do, that's all I ever wanted to do. And
awesome.
And so it was, you know, I couldn't believe that you could actually, you can actually make money doing this? And so that was my ultimate goal, was to make a living making video games.
And it sounds like your parents were pretty supportive of your habit and
your
desires.
They were definitely supportive in that they, you know, funded me, got me a computer and things like that, and gave me the space and time to actually learn how to program. And then, you know, I was able to advance quite a bit. And in high school, I was working at Pacific Bell doing a lot of modem communication software and stuff like that. And so really through that experience, I was able to kind of like, people thought, oh, it's legitimate. He can actually, you know, make software and make it, you know, this could be a career for him.
Right.
My parents thought that my path should be, you know, doing business things, not
sure.
necessarily. I get my computer science degree, and then I come out, I want to make video games. It's like, I'll see you in 6 months when you move back here. And then my paychecks are bouncing. I'm like, oh my God, it's coming true or whatever. But eventually it worked out.
That's awesome. Do you ever remember wanting to be anything other than a game developer when you grew up?
No, I mean, I thought that really honestly that business software bored the hell out of me. And so I didn't want to do that. Like, that was not something that was really that interesting. I always thought that gaming was just much more interesting to me. And that's where my passion's always been.
So you leave Iguana in 93. You co-found Condor, Max and Eric, which would later become Blizzard North, which we'll get to, I promise. So what was your... what was your sort of motivation to take that risk to go out on your own? I mean, I know the company moved to Texas, but it takes some stones, I think, some courage to say, hey, I'll start this on my own.
Yeah, I guess, or you just have to be young and naive.
that helps, right?
And you know, I didn't know what I was doing. We were three dudes with computers, you know. It's like we didn't have business degrees. We didn't know anything about running a business. We were just kind of flying by the seat of our pants. It was like, okay, well, I figured. So because I had done Arrow the Acrobat, and because I had done this, worked on slightly on NBA Jam, and had done the Super High Impact Football, I knew people at Acclaim and at Sunsoft, and that we were able to get kind of contract jobs to do new products or whatever from both of them. And we got to do a Quarterback Club from Acclaim, working on the Game Boy and Game Gear for versions of Quarterback Club, and then getting to do Justice League Task Force.
That's where we're going next.
For Sunsoft. Yeah, and so that with it, so I said, hey, I know some people. I think that I can get us some contracts. So the risk seemed kind of minimal.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that. And we didn't know what we were doing and all these kind of things. So I think that really all with the risk mitigation of, I think we can get us a contract, and the fact that, you know, we had nothing to lose. It was easy.
But if, you know, with all due respect to Quarterback Club and those types of things, are you having any fun doing those sort of contract things? Or is it just like, are you just focused on, I got to make it. I got to build a career here?
That's a really good question, because I'm not really sure the answer. The fact is that, I mean, working on video games was the only thing that I wanted to do, so it didn't really matter to me that it was going to be, you know, a conversion or whatever.
Right.
I just wanted to do it and get some experience doing it. I mean, I had ideas for my own things, but it was more important to me to actually make whatever.
That's a healthy attitude.
Yeah, well, it's not just that. It was also, I love sports and I love football. And so making a football game was fun, you know. And then so we chose projects that we were passionate about. You know, making Justice League Task Force, it was like, I love comics and I love Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman, Flash and all of this. So I would love to do a video game with them in it. And, I would love to do a football game because I love sports and I love football. And so it was kind of combining, even though it was kind of, you know, the parameters were limited. We couldn't do whatever we wanted. We still had a lot of freedom in what we were able to do.
That's awesome. So you just mentioned Justice League Task Force.
Yes.
What's interesting about that, I learned, in researching you was that another developer who would this is just all you could never even write this if you were writing like a sitcom, let alone a drama. But another developer called Silicon and Synapse, which we'll get to that. If you don't know who they are, we'll get to them in a second. But they, it turned out, had been contracted to make the game also.
Right.
So you and Silicon and Synapse, Condor and Silicon and Synapse, were both working on different versions of the same thing.
Right, exactly. But it was even stranger than that. So we'd been contracted to do the... So when they pitched us, hey, here's a few different products that, if you're interested, will, you know, you can have these jobs. Here's Justice League Task Force. Here's the Aerosmith game. Here's the, you know, there are like three or four different choices or whatever. And we said, well, we'd like to do Justice League Task Force. And they're like, are you sure? Yeah, we're sure. All right, or whatever. So we're going to give you the Genesis version. Okay, great. I had a lot of experience on the Genesis. I love the 68000. So the processor was really easy to program. Because everything was, everything was written in assembly language at the time. You know, it was easy to write in. There were a lot of... I'm getting too technical here, but there are
that's exactly what the show is for.
It was, you know, there are lots of ways that you can hold information. It was easy to access information, and the architecture was great. And so, you know, I thought that, you know, that working on the Genesis, that sounds right up my alley. So we thought that we were the only version in this game. And we show up at CES. Now, before E3, you know, we would all go to Consumer Electronics Show, and we were...
In January.
Yeah,
right?
exactly. Or in Chicago in the summertime.
Right.
And that was when there were two of them. I think there's only one now. But the and we were in a section, the video games were like, right next to the car stereos, so it was like thump, 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 thump all day. Well, it was much like E3. So we would be next to the refrigerators and the car stereos, and here's video games, and so we show up at Consumer Electronics Show, and wait, there's another version of this game. Somebody, there's another developer making the same game. Like, we had never met, we had never discussed anything, we had never shared ideas, we had never knew that there was another version or another developer working on the Super Nintendo version of the product at the time. And so it was, we showed up, and the games were oddly similar.
It's a fighting game.
They're a fighting game,
You'd arrived at similar conclusions.
Almost exactly, and like, had nearly identical settings, and like, all... I mean, it was really weird. And so we showed up, and so we kind of talked with them and got to know them and stuff.
Is it a friendly thing, or is it like a, hey, F these guys?
No, not at all. I mean, they were kind of busy at the time because they were just coming out with the Death of Superman game or something like that. I can't remember exactly which one it was, but it was something along those lines. They had a Superman game that they were just finishing, or it was just being published, and Justice League was still a year out or so. And so, you know, that I think that that time frame, you know, it was very friendly. It was shocking to both of us, but there was no animosity. It wasn't like, oh my God, I can't believe that we didn't get both versions of this product. I'm upset that we didn't grow our company or something like that. Neither team really felt that way.
Is it like a fast friends kind of thing because of this?
I mean, it was because the games were so similar. It was like, oh, it's kind of, and then we just kept talking and talking, and then they said, well, you know, we're working on a PC game. And he said, oh, really? I'd love to see it. And, you know, that's what we really want to do. Yeah. I mean, we're really passionate about PC games, and I've got some ideas for PC games, and, you know, that's kind of a passion of ours. So eventually that's where I want my career to go. And they said, well, you know, why don't we have a little booth. It was like a, you know, 10 by 10
like
little.
A table?
Yeah, exactly. It was like a 10 by 10 little room that was jam-packed. It had, you know, it was like high, you know, walls that you'd find like in an office or whatever. You know, it was just barely a room. You could call it a room, but it was like, it wasn't really a room. And so we kind of went in there, and they showed off Warcraft 1. And I was like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, David, whose version was better of Justice League Task Force? Enough time has passed.
Honestly, there were things I think I liked about both versions. Yeah. Overall, I think that theirs played a little bit better than the Genesis, the Super Nintendo one did. But there were some of the moves and stuff that I liked better out of the Genesis one.
Nice. All right, so that's a humble but fair fair answer. And it's how odd is it that this licensed fighting game, it basically ends up leading to Diablo?
Yeah.
It is weird. In the annals of history.
It is the strangest coincidence for this to all kind of come together in some weird kind of universe where this chance meeting ends up, hey, we've sold our company. We're changing our name to Blizzard, and we're making Warcraft 1 in the other room. Or, it's whoa, wow, that's really weird. That's really cool. And for that to just kind of lead to where it led is amazing.
So tell me the story of partnering with them and becoming Blizzard North then. If they're setting up shop, they're worrying about trying to get Warcraft done, but you've clearly hit it off, and then you've just been talking about, hey, you've got ideas for games, so connect those dots for me.
Yeah, they were finishing up Warcraft 1, and it was January that we had seen it, and we had been talking, kind of emailing back and forth and chatting and stuff, and by the summertime rolled around, there was some article or whatever, because this was like largely pre-internet. I mean, the internet existed, but it was, still right in its infancy.
It's gaming magazine era.
Exactly, it's gaming magazine era. And so there was something, the beta's coming soon or something. So I called up Alan and I said, hey, it would be, if you guys need some help testing, I know a bunch of people here would be really enthusiastic about giving you some feedback or whatever. So he said, yeah, and then we would talk, and I said, well, we've got all these ideas. I really want to make a PC game. And he said, well, after Warcraft 1, we're really busy for the rest of the year, but after Warcraft 1, we'll fly up and you can pitch us an idea. We're supposed to, we just got bought by Davidson Associates, and we're trying to build Davidson Associates was an educational entertainment company,
yeah,
that made Math Blaster and Reading Blaster and a whole bunch of they're huge, and so they had kind of dominated the edutainment market and were looking to branch out and do entertainment as well, and so their initiative was to try and make this a bigger division, so they needed more people making games, and so they came out after they finished Warcraft 1, and that's when we pitched them Diablo.
Well, so what's Condor doing in the meantime, then, if you're waiting for...
Well, we were still working on other products. Okay. I mean, we were still working on... Justice League was not finished yet, okay, and in fact, it finished, in the spring or summer after we had pitched Diablo.
Oh, wow.
We had actually started and signed Diablo when we were still working on... still working on the end of Justice League. And then we had gotten another version of Quarterback Club, and so, because they were doing one a year or whatever,
yeah,
so we were just kind of cranking out the next one. And so we were still doing other projects besides that. And then eventually we did we got a contract with 3DO.
So you've already started on Diablo.
Yes.
And it was originally turn-based, was it not?
That is true.
Which is unfathomable to think of now.
It was single player.
Yep.
Turn-based. DOS.
DOS is forgivable. I mean, it's...
Yeah. I mean, this was the very edge of Windows 95, yeah, and DirectX. So, everybody likes to say it was Claymation. Blizzard likes to tout that it was Claymation. It was Claymation. That is true for about, a month or something like,
yeah,
that, until the realities of what that would entail kind of set in. There was an arcade machine at the time, Primal Rage, that had these
Claymation
amazing
dinosaurs.
Claymation,
fighting.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're like, oh, wouldn't it be really cool to add that to the PC game? And so those were some of the original concepts. Also, also, one of the things was the it was going to have a lot of DLC. This was before DLC even existed. It was kind of taking from Magic the Gathering and buying packs of stuff that you could add onto onto your game.
So who, at what point does the idea come along for, what if we made this real-time combat?
Yeah, you know, the rumor is that the Blizzard Entertainment, Blizzard South guys came out of the pitch meeting and they're like, amazing idea, two things wrong with it. I can't remember what one was, but the other was, it needs to be real time. And they had just done the same kind of process with Warcraft, taking kind of the turn-based strategy and making it real-time, and they saw that as kind of the push for the future. And so taking something that was turn-based and making it real-time seemed like right up their alley. And so we signed the contract. They didn't say anything. And so it took a little while, and we started making the game, and it was kind of complicated turn-based. It wasn't I go, you go. Like different turns took different amounts of time and things like that. So it was kind of like a sliding scale turn base. And so, we were working on it for several months. And then the inevitable phone call of, so what do you think about changing it to real time from turn based? And I'm like, that's a terrible idea. That's a terrible idea. Part of the reason was I really didn't want to lose what I felt was like the heart and soul of roguelikes. I was a huge Rogue, Moria, Angband, NetHack fan. I had played countless hours of these games. And so I wanted to kind of capture that spirit. And one of the things that I loved about the game was that decisions really mattered.
Yeah.
And so you're fighting something, and you're gonna die. And when you die, your character's deleted. And so it's like, I've been working on this character for 3 days, and I'm down to my end here, and I've got like 3 turns left. What am I gonna do? Am I going to read some scroll that God knows what it does, because it hasn't been identified? Am I going to quaff this potion of poison and hope that it somehow it like has some reverse effect or whatever it is. Like am I going to just straight up attack the thing? Am I going to try and flee? Am I going to have enough time to actually escape to the surface in some kind of meaningful way? And inevitably, you died. And I cry and slam my fists on the desks and rage quit for 2 days and then come back and start again. So I love the tension that was there. And I felt with going with real time, like that's out the window, right? I can't make those split second decisions. That's not the intensity. I can't stand up from my chair and walk around the room and going, oh my God, I can't believe I've got myself in this situation. And this is so intense. And so I really said, no way are we going to do real time. But I brought it up to the, others. What's the phone call about? Oh, they want to make it real time. And so eventually it just kind of spread throughout the office that it wanted to be.
It was a crescendoing wave of support.
Yeah, and it was. And, there were just a few of us that were kind of the holdouts. We're going to make sure that, it's going to lose everything. And eventually, it was very democratic. We went into the kitchen and had a vote. And
how close was it?
It wasn't close at all.
No.
It was like, 3 against 15 or something, it was like, I said, okay, tell you what, I'll go talk to Blizzard and tell them that we've decided to change it. And so I called up Blizzard and I said, we'll do the change, but it's going to take more money and more time.
Sure.
This is a big change. And so we need an extra, milestone payment out of this. And these are the kind of tricks that you learn as you become savvy businessmen. And so I said, okay, we'll I'll start on it this weekend. And this was like on a Friday. And then we'll reconvene and we'll see how it goes this weekend. And we'll see how it plays on Monday. And so a lot of the people went home. And I started working on it, and it turned out that it wasn't that difficult to change it. I was able to basically...
Keep that under your hat, though.
Yeah, well, the word's out already. But the and it was a long time ago. But the, you know, because we had kind of broken the thing down into these, like, micro turns, I just ran a bunch of turns, you know, very quickly. And then, the you know, to get the character kind of, you know, moving across the screen, it just, like, sent so many turns to make them move. And so, like, it didn't take very long for it to actually code up. And, in fact, I coded it up in the afternoon. And so, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. I can still, this is the most vivid moment of my career, where I was sitting at my computer, and I was playing this, we had really the only character class we had at the time was this warrior. And there was a skeleton on the other side, and I clicked on the mouse button, and he walked over, and he went like that, and it like busted apart, and I was like, "Oh my God, that is amazing! That felt so good!" And you know, it was just like something out of a Monty Python
That's
movie,
cool.
where they the clouds parted and the angels sang, and it was like, "Oh my God!" It was an amazing moment, and so that. I knew right then that I was wrong and that the right choice was to make this real time. So people came back on Monday and I had the whole thing done. And they're like, "Oh my God, this is amazing." And we just kind of rolled after that. It was really easy to see that this was going to be something amazing and different.
How long do you wait before you tell Blizzard South about it? Because you just demanded more time and more money.
Yeah, they caught on pretty quickly. But they were very honorable. I mean, it didn't last that long because they ended up buying us a few months later.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was not like we had to hold out on that secret for too long.
So if that's the moment where everything sort of clicks, I want to sort of get your take. Because this is the part where, like, for me, I remember Diablo becoming, like, the hype for it peaking. You guys did a public beta not too long before the game came out, where, if I remember right, it was a CD that was sent out.
Correct.
You had to be, like, randomly drawn. I don't know how random, I'm sure you had your VIP list and all that, but, And I remember the winners, if you won a copy of the beta, like they just straight put the people's names on a website somewhere, which would never never happen now. And so I remember it being like winning the lottery, except I didn't win. A friend of mine fortunately got it, so I did get to see it before the game came out. But how do you remember it as being this frenzy for the beta once it was finally getting to that point?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there were several stages of this. Towards the end, Microsoft came to us and wanted us to make it DirectX.
Sure.
And we're like, I don't know, you just had this whatever. I don't remember what it was called, but it was like GDI Plus or some kind of like thing that like flopped on its face. They were trying to do the same thing as DirectX, but it just didn't work. So I was like, what makes this going to be different? And they said, well, we're going to send out a million CDs. I said, okay, we'll do it. So you know, we said, okay, we'll convert it to DirectX, and it turned out to be the right decision. So this kind of demo disc went out, and the demo disc, we gave it to PC Gamer, and we gave it to DirectX, and so you could get this kind of little demo disc. And this came out maybe September-ish time frame before it was going to launch it around Christmas. It was supposed to be before Christmas.
We'll get to that
after Christmas.
Yeah.
But with that demo, we were able to kind of like hone a lot of the game. But we just thought of the second phase of that was the actual beta, and the beta was supposed to be a BattleNet beta, because we had had in the very first game to ever be on BattleNet was Diablo 1.
Yeah.
In fact, it was invented for Diablo 6 months before the game came out.
Wow.
And so, you know, in the summertime, they said, "So, how's that multiplayer coming along?" It's come along real well. We'd never done anything multiplayer. I didn't know anything about networking code or whatever. And so I said, well, great, because we've got this great idea where we're going to be able to play with people out of the box. you know, over the internet. And I'm like, oh, man, that sounds amazing or whatever. We're going to need some help. And so luckily they had a couple people that are networking experts and could take the time to come up to our offices up in San Mateo. I think we were at San Mateo, maybe Redwood City at the time, and help us out. So the people kind of came up and helped us make it multiplayer and did a lot of the heavy lifting. And then the down south, they were actually making the Battle.net,
right,
you know, back end.
The client.
It was Mike O'Brien was doing most of the stuff, who's now Arena.net. And then Pat Wyatt, who came up, and he's the CTO at Amazon doing Lumberyard. So they came up and they helped us out or whatever to convert the game and make it actually a multiplayer game. And so we added basically multiplayer and internet support in the last 6 months.
Wow.
And meanwhile, this beta is going. I mean, this demo disc is coming on. We got all sorts of, like, we didn't have a hotbar in Diablo 1 until after the demo disc. So that was like some addition in the last 2 or 3 months of the project.
That never happens anymore. You can't do that. Not on a AAA game.
Yeah, not even, there's nothing like that happening. So we're making decisions like we're going to make it multiplayer 6 months before it's getting, you know, it's going to ship. So anyway, so all of this stuff with the beta and all that really built up because the demo disc had come out. People were psyched and people really got hyped. And we announced the beta thing and it was like within minutes the thing was full or whatever. Yeah. Like I think it crashed the site. We weren't ready for it. You know, it was like the list was too long. It was, you know, it was kind of a mess. So we had to like figure out how are we going to actually hand this out, and then unfortunately some people won the lottery and some didn't.
Yeah, well, it all worked out in the end, I guess. Still got to play the game. But
RNGs is a tricky mistress, that's for sure.
So you mentioned this a minute ago, but Diablo ended up shipping on New Year's Eve of 1996,
right.
December 31st. That would never happen now, right? You couldn't possibly blow your Christmas window and then ship on New Year's Eve?
It was weird. I mean,
what happened? Just optimization, polish stuff, or was there?
Well,
a specific...
there were a lot of things going on. One thing for me personally was that my wife was 9 months pregnant, and so you know, days before supposed to be finishing up or whatever, I'm having contractions. I'm like, I gotta go, guys, and so you know, the baby wasn't born then, but it was the, you know, going through the process of having a pregnant wife at the very end of this was, you know, added on top for me personally.
Sure.
Luckily, you know, she was born 3 days after we shipped. But it was very nice of her to wait. It just took a long time, right? Everything ended up taking up a lot longer than we thought it would. We worked really hard. We were there all the time. We were crunching endlessly. But things just, like, when you're making big decisions, like, let's make it multiplayer 6 months before you're going to ship, there's going to be ramifications to these decisions. We're going to make a DirectX. We're going to, like, do all these things that are unscheduled and unplanned and, like, you know, things that nobody would ever really do these days unless you have an infinite budget and you're working with a small team or something. So, which doesn't exist. So, I think that we made the correct decisions, but we just tried to jam it into too tight of a window.
Gotcha. I wanted to ask, who came up with the ending of Diablo? Because, boy, it was shocking back then when that stone goes, no, what just happened?
So that was largely the cinematics team.
Who were, there were gold
six
standard.
Or eight guys down there that, you know, I mean, I don't know how big the team was eventually, but they started out kind of small. And the cinematic team, and so we were kind of hands off with the cinematics, and then they show it to us the first time, and I'm like, oh my god, what just happened?
So they wrote this that
they wrote
the
that
story?
Ending, correct?
Wow.
And I was like, what? This isn't what we talked about. This isn't. Wait, what? What just happened? Or, you know, and it's too late now to change it or whatever. I hated it. I was like, oh my god, no, we cannot have this. This is terrible or whatever. And then, you know, I walked away I thought about it for a few days, and I was like, you know, actually, it's not that bad. It's kind of good. I think I like this now.
Diablo.
It took me a few days to kind of like warm up to it or whatever. Yeah. My initial reaction was, oh God, no, please, no, you ruined the game. But then as I thought about it, I was like, you know, it's kind of cool. I think that it's weird and twisted and whatnot. You know, I was so...
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow... grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Like, back then, I was just a very different person, right? You know, I had grown up in kind of a weird, you know, white privilege kind of way or whatever, and everything was kind of neat and organized and tidy and all these kind of things. And so for something like this to happen was like, oh my God, I can't believe that this is exactly the opposite of the decisions that I would make, right? Which is a good thing because it ended up actually giving it character. But now I see how artful that was and how important that was really to the franchise and how you know, again, I was young and didn't know what I was doing.
When you were saying, oh, this isn't what we talked about, was there something else sketched out that they were supposed to do?
We had talked about, you know, what we wanted out of the cinematics, and they were just, you know, summarily rejected. You know, there was, we're going to do whatever. And that's fine. I mean, in all honesty, that's the right thing to do. Even though it was kind of a sneaky thing to do, it was, you know, it was, at the same time, it was the right thing to do. Because when somebody's working on something and it's something creative, having them passionately involved about something they're creating and making it their own is super important. And if you're telling them what to do, it's just not going to be as good as if it's something that they're inspiring to do.
Yeah, makes sense. So after that, you had an excellent expansion pack for Diablo, adding my favorite character, the Barbarian, so that's your reaction, fuels my next question. Is there a story behind that expansion? Was it...
behind Hellfire?
Yes. Was it not something you wanted to do? Was it
there's a lot of story behind that one.
I have all day. That's what this show is.
It was... So at the time we had finished Diablo 1, and Davidson came to us and said, we really want an expansion for Diablo 1. It's selling so well, and you guys are making these expansions, and they sell just about as well.
Back then, expansions were a big part of the business.
Absolutely. So they came to us and said, we want you to work on an expansion. We said, we're not going to do that, right? We're going to focus, there are some critical problems with Diablo 1 that we really want to solve, and we're going to move on and make Diablo 2. And, you know, number one thing is to try and prevent the cheating, right? Yeah. You got to the cheating's ruining the game, and we've got to move on and fix that and change it to client server. It's a big deal, but it's going to take us years. But the we got to put that behind us and move on to the second version. And they said, well, what if you guys got to produce it and we got a Sierra team to make the game? And I said, okay, well, come on, because Sierra Online and Blizzard Entertainment were both owned right. by the same company,
yeah.
Which was Sendent at the time. And so they said, okay, well, we'll give the project to this team over at Sierra, and they can make it, and we'll produce it or whatever. And so they started to make it, and there were some things that we were happy about. Their initial design, they came back, and I'm like, oh, I don't want this and that and some other stuff or whatever. This isn't really in the spirit of what we're trying to do and whatnot. And as the project went on, they kind of just ignored our feedback. And so it came down to the end, and they said, okay, well, we're ready. And I said, well, we're not gonna publish this. We're not gonna make this. This isn't what we envisioned. This isn't, you guys aren't listening to the changes that I think are super necessary.
Yeah.
And then they published it without my permission.
Wow.
And I was really upset about it.
That seems like maybe a bad idea, because wouldn't they be worried about you leaving the company?
Well, not really, because I was just so involved with Diablo 2, and it was something I really wanted to do, but it was a risk that they had to take for sure. And I was, I was very upset about the fact that I felt like this decision was out of my hands, and I was jumping up and down about how this isn't right for Diablo, and this isn't what I wanted, and they aren't listening to our feedback, and they aren't doing anything about it. And, unfortunately, a lot of people lost jobs over it, but I didn't want this to take away from, I didn't want Hellfire to kind of, like, tarnish the Diablo legacy, because we had built something up so great, that we was having so much success with it, that I just felt like this was going a different direction than I wanted the series to go. And I didn't really have a hand in it.
So when I just told you that I liked Hellfire, did your ears start gushing blood?
No, not at all. There are a lot of people that do like it. And yeah. Maybe I made the right decision or not the right decision or whatever. There were some things about it that just really bugged me. Overall, I thought that the expansion was fine. There was having the extra character classes and some of the graphics and things like that were really kind of neat. But some of the quests and things like that and some of the naming conventions and whatnot, there were problems with with the way that I think it was being presented.
And as I remember, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, you couldn't play the Barbarian online until there was like a ludicrously simple, for lack of a better term, hack. Like, I think you had to like edit an INI file or some file, I think, in the game's folder. If you just like changed a thing, you could suddenly take the Barbarian online.
Yeah. Those were the kind of things that that were really, top-notch about the product.
All right, so I do want to tell you on camera, since I have the opportunity, we were talking a bit at lunch before this, but my goodness, I think for me, Diablo 2 is one of absolutely at least the 10 best games ever made.
That's
one of my favorite parts of this, selfishly, is I get to tell the creator. Like, I had Warren Spector in here, and I got to say thank you for Deus Ex, and gosh, thank you for Diablo and Diablo 2. I love those
games
so much.
You're very welcome. It's not just me, though. There are a lot of talented people that worked on this.
Sure,
product,
but you're here. But you
thank
get,
you.
Yeah,
thank you. No, I appreciate it nonetheless.
And at what point, so you figured out... It sounded like you really knew you had something special when you got real-time up and running with Diablo 1. But Diablo 2, to me, is almost just erases Diablo 1 from existence, because that's how good 2 was, in my opinion. It just took everything about the first game and made it bigger, made it better, and took it in ways that you expected it to go and didn't expect it to go. Are you confident, like, right out of the gate with developing Diablo 2, or is there some point in the project where you're like, this is really good? Like, is there a moment of clarity, or does it not work that way?
It doesn't really work that way. Oftentimes, you're just way too close to a product to see, you know, the big view and how good it is or not is, right? It's very difficult because you're making all sorts of decisions all the time. And some of them you make, you think, oh, that was a good decision or not a good decision. Like, I look back at it now and I'm like, why did I have a stamina bar in Diablo 2? That doesn't make any sense, right? You know, it seemed to make sense at the time, but, you know, we've convinced ourselves that, but there are things about the game that certainly aren't perfect. And so you make these decisions, you're close, you know, was this the right decision, the wrong decision? And for instance, there was this decision that we made late in the project. At one point, I was playing a lot of other games during Diablo 2's development as well, but one of the games I was playing the most of was EverQuest. And so they would, like, you would kill things and you would get, you know, fur and, you know, things like that you could make craft stuff out of. And I said, well, it'd be really cool to kind of put it, almost a crafting system, but make it Diablo-styled crafting system. So we put in this part where you would kill monsters and body parts would come out. And so there were like eyeballs and hearts and wings and like all sorts of stuff or whatever. And eventually after having it in for a few months, you know, Alan called me and he's like, yeah, I really like what you're doing or whatever, but my inventory is disgusting. It's just filled with gore. You know, it's like this. We can't. I don't know if this is really a great idea or whatever. I'm like, oh God, I think you're probably right or whatever. And so we removed the body parts or whatever, and there was just a riot in the office. People just hated this decision. There was like this protest. People hung up signs, bring the body parts back, and things like that. That was Was that the right decision? I don't know, or whatever. Would that made it a better game? Would it made it worse? So it's like when you're that close to something, it's really hard to tell if it's going to be great or not because you're making all these weird decisions all the time.
What's your favorite character to play in either Diablo game?
Probably Barbarian.
Yes.
I love melee. I love the visceral feel and the jumping around and. You know that, so I think that that's probably the class I've played the most.
Were there any characters that hit the cutting room floor for Diablo 2? That made it a decent way along, like prototyped or something?
No, we didn't really waste our time on prototype stuff. If we thought of a character class, we just added it pretty much. I think that there were some things that that we did. So I designed another expansion for Diablo 2 that had new character classes in it, and so those never made it in. But other than that, I think that those are the only ones that I can think of that that didn't make it.
Interesting. So at this point, Diablo's huge with 1 and 2. Obviously, the Warcraft is and Starcraft are enormous from out of Blizzard South. Did a rivalry ever develop? I mean, you started from such a common bond, but does it ever get like either maybe sales wise? Because you know Blizzard is selling more games than pretty much anybody else. So is there a rivalry at all? Friendly rivalry, or is it still? Just
I think there was friendly rivalry, but you know it was never really
bloodthirsty.
There were definitely heated conversations between both sides or whatever about you know agreeing and disagreeing on whatever. God, I can still remember a terrible, terrible phone call I had with Mike Morheim I was so rude. And anyway, you look back on mistakes that you've made in your life. That was one of my big ones. I think that there definitely was a rivalry. But in the end, we were Blizzard, and we were passionate about what we were doing. And we would give feedback on each other's games, and we'd present new ideas and stuff like that. And our ideas would make it into all the different titles or whatever. And so it was a very collaborative effort. And so there were just so many talented people, and they were largely egoless. And being able to give people feedback and take that feedback and make a better product, it was just kind of a special thing. I feel it's like it was just a really strange mix of people that worked really well together.
And you were telling me a story earlier, which I'm hoping you won't mind me bring up now, is that sort of attitude that you're alluding to. I brought up Warcraft Adventures as a game that, because I was a huge point-and-click LucasArts adventure game fan, and here's Blizzard making a beautifully cel-shaded style, visual style, point-and-click graphic adventure, and you actually took large responsibility earlier for killing it.
That's correct.
So I was wondering, I don't know if you can tell that story.
So we were making, the guys down south were kind of producing this product, and they had, I don't remember who was doing the engine. I think the engine was, so Davidson had all of these different games, and a lot of them were these kind of point-and-click adventure games, the educational putt-putty type games and things like that. They said, well, we'll just reskin it for Warcraft. And so Blizzard said, oh, we think that's a great idea, the guys down south. And they started working on it, and they started recording lines and wrote out the story and all the different things or whatever. And we kept playing it and kept giving feedback and things like that. And eventually, I said, guys, this isn't kind of a modern game. It doesn't feel like a big evolution in Blizzard. It doesn't feel like this is really something significant. It feels like a Me Too product that doesn't really have anything that's revolutionary in it or anything that's different, and it's kind of a basic point-and-click adventure game. And, I don't think that we should do this product. And one of the speeches that I had given many times is that I didn't want to go out. A lot of companies, they want to go out and they want you to make as many games as you can possibly make.
Right.
We want to make this business as big as possible.
Quantity over quality.
Yeah, exactly. And so make everything. And I said, I don't want to be kind of the GM of video games. I want to be the Ferrari of video games.
Yeah.
And so is this a Ferrari? And they agreed that it's not. And so it got canceled.
So it was good, but maybe it was just not good enough.
Just wasn't the best.
Yeah.
And I felt like we needed to have the best.
So circling back to Diablo for a couple more minutes. A while back, Blizzard hired some folks to, there was like a job listing for what more or less amounted to making Diablo 2 work on modern machines. We're still waiting to see any fruits of that in a public manner, but have you heard anything? Like, it needs to come back, right?
Yeah, there are so many people that ask me this question.
I mean,
I get this question all the time.
I know you don't work there anymore, but...
No, I don't know anything about what's going on. I can say, from a technical standpoint, it's going to be extremely difficult. That you will not be able to capture it exactly the way it was. And the number one reason is because of the shape of the screen.
Hmm.
Because the screens back then were 800 by 600, largely rectangular,
right.
And now they're not. They're 16 by 9, 16 by 10. We did a lot of tricks. A lot of the ways that the AI and stuff activates is from off screen.
Huh.
And so, like, it's just off of screen or whatever, then it starts kind of, like, getting activated and doing stuff. So if they were going to keep the same radius of awareness, you would get a whole bunch of things on the edge of the screen just kind of, like, getting ready to do something here. But if you don't, then everything's kind of coming from different angles and at different speeds and doing different things than you're used to and the way it's run. Not only that, but a lot of modern games, they just use a giant grid to do pathing and things like that on. And part of the reason that Diablo plays the way it does is because of the grid that's underneath. And so you would have to mimic that kind of movement and grid that's underneath underneath Diablo 2 in order for it to really kind of have the same feel. So I wouldn't say it's impossible. There are huge technical challenges. And then you have things like, I'll bring it up again, the stamina bar.
Yeah.
Stamina bar is kind of a useless feature in Diablo 2. Do you remove that? Well, if you remove that, then, you start, what do you
what
remove?
What else do you do? Yeah.
What do you remove and what don't you remove? Do you put buyback in? Do you put respecs back in or put them in? The modern games are very different than old games. And then all of a sudden, do you have the same game? I'm not really sure. Anyway, it's a big challenge. And I'll be eager to see what they do if they decide to do something. But it will never be exact. It wouldn't be Diablo 2 exactly with just better graphics. Yeah. That just wouldn't exist.
So you're telling me, David, that we can't just go file save as Windows 10.exe?
Yeah.
It's not how it works.
Just one line of code. Awesome graphics equals one. You know, that's it. And then we're done.
I remember Blizzard was famous for doing awesome April Fool's Day jokes for a long time.
Yes.
Whose idea was the Deckard Cain rap? You remember that one?
Yeah, of course I do. I don't remember whose idea.
So good.
I think the biggest April Fool's. So we've done a whole bunch of April Fool's publicly. We also did internal April Fool's. And one of the internal April Fool's jokes that I played, which is just so mean, is that this was after Diablo 1 and before StarCraft. And StarCraft was behind schedule. And so I gathered everybody up on April 1st and I said, StarCraft is in trouble and it's not going to meet this year. And we're all going to go move down to Southern California for a few months and help them out on the project. And everybody was just like, oh my God, I can't go down to Southern California for several months and stuff. And I let it go the whole day.
Oh, and nobody figured out that it was April 1st?
And I said, April Fools or whatever. And oh my God, people were so upset. So that started kind of a tradition of all of these like April Fools jokes. And then it kind of became public and we did a whole bunch of, you know, April Fools are, you know, everywhere now. A lot of companies do them or whatever. But this wasn't really a time where that was really something that happened.
Yeah,
I mean, people still did it, but it was not really done at companies. But I did have everybody kind of going for a while on the StarCraft.
Look up the Deckard Cain rap on YouTube if you have no idea what I'm talking about. It's super good. All right, so what was, before you left, what was the Diablo-style game in space idea that was being kicked around?
Yeah, well, it didn't have a name. I mean, we called it Starblow. the idea was going to be, you know, it was basically Diablo in space, same kind of perspective, and there would be different planets and things like that. And so, you know, it had just was in its infancy, and it was going to be, you know, 3D graphics and when I was going to kind of upgrade on the Diablo 2 stuff.
Yeah.
Diablo 2 was kind of the end of the kind of sprite-based stuff for Blizzard.
Yeah, as I recall, it had 3D accelerator support, even though it was a 2D game.
Yeah, one of the things I thought of, one of the things I'm, I guess, infamous for is this something that people nicknamed my shower ideas, because I would come in and say, I had this idea in the shower this morning, which meant, oh, God, this is several weeks of work for somebody. Anyway, I had this idea in the shower where it was going to be, oh, I could kind of mock 3D the entire world. Because 3D was everywhere. Everybody was using it. It was like, if you weren't doing 3D, it was kind of old-fashioned. So here was an opportunity to kind of do this infinite parallax on the world. I could kind of pseudo-construct the world out of kind of polygons and sprites and make this kind of faux 3D world. And I called it perspective mode, and so that became kind of this 3D accelerated stuff. But it was never really designed for that, and the memory on the cards was limited at the time. And so we did all of these things to kind of like upload textures all the time, and it was really tough to get it to kind of optimize and make it run really well. But eventually, we got it working.
So go back to the Starblow thing. So is it just a case of it's not a Ferrari, so.
No, Starblow was in development. We were doing two projects. We were going to be working on Diablo 3 and Starblow. We had decided to kind of split the company into two different projects. And we had tried a couple little prototypes of different things that we, up north, we had not really been happy with any of the prototypes, and there were problems with all the game ideas we had. But I think that we finally had landed on something with the Starblow idea. And so it was kind of fresh in development, as well as Diablo 3 was maybe, yeah, I don't know, I can't even remember, maybe 2 years in development, year and a half into development, something like that. But we were making our own 3D engine and tools and all sorts of stuff, so, and ramping up and growing the company into two teams, and so it was going to take a little while.
What did your version of Diablo 3 look like?
different than Diablo 3 ended up looking like. You know, our art style up north was different than the art style from the guys down south, and so in a lot of ways, it was you know, much more like Diablo 2 looking than it was what Diablo 3 ended up looking like.
What did I'm sure you get asked this all the time too. What did you think of the Diablo 3 that ultimately shipped?
I think that Diablo 3 ended up being a great game. You know, especially after the expansion, I thought that they added a lot of really great stuff to it that that flushed it out and made a much better game than I thought that it was at launch. But you know, I thought that it was a fine game at launch, and I think that it really kind of held up the Diablo legacy.
So you, along with Bill Roper and some other folks, left to form Flagship Studios.
Correct.
And your first project, which was, you know, immediately you've got key personnel from Blizzard North and gets a ton of attention right away. Hellgate London, which was sort of a first person 3D Diablo type game, I think is reasonably fair to say. Was there a lot of pressure to have a big hit when you're sort of branch out from the big, you know, it's like leaving the Rolling Stones to form.
Right.
You know, whatever else.
Yeah, exactly.
Or was it just sort of a feeling of relief being out on your own again?
You know, there were problems that we had, not with Blizzard, but with kind of the management and the companies that own Blizzard. And so, in some ways, it was nice to be rid of that burden. And but at the same time, you know, I was leaving my baby, and that was very, very difficult. I think that you know, I pitched the idea. In fact, that's exactly Hellgate was. The idea was we're going to kind of cross, you know, Quake meets Diablo is basically the concept or whatever, the high concept that I pitched. We got together the next day in my living room or whatever and said, oh, what game are we going to make? And I pitched this and everybody's like, sounds good. So we did that. But, you know, that I think that we're going out and we made a bunch of mistakes making Hellgate London. We, you know, hyped too early. It was naturally going to be overhyped. And then in the end, we didn't deliver a quality product, right? We kind of ran out of money. We had all sorts of financial problems. We didn't know how to run a business really well. There were a lot of harsh lessons that we learned doing that. In the end, I'm super proud of Hellgate. I think that especially after some of the patches and things like that, it ended up becoming quite a great game. And I think it's a game that was way ahead of its time. And so, you know, now you're seeing a lot of first-person shooters with more RPG elements and things like that. And this was kind of like the start of that with all this randomization and all these different classes and all this kind of stuff. So I think that we were really onto something special, and we just finished it too early and didn't give it enough time. But we didn't really have much of a choice because we were kind of running out of money and we mismanaged the end and really didn't tighten it up enough, and it was too buggy when it came out.
And you had plans for a whole franchise, right? Like Hellgate : New
Tokyo.
City here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tokyo was the next one, and we had started working on it. And so it was, there were all sorts of different places we were going to go and different cities we were going to kind of visit and destroy. anyway, so it was, I thought that the whole theme and the look and stuff, it had like kind of its unique aesthetic, and it felt really dark and creepy. And so I liked a lot about it, but again, it was just kind of a mismanagement of the entire experience. And a lot of that can fall on my shoulders or any of the executives' shoulders that were running Flagship.
When you're making it, are you sort of motivated by like wanting to stick it to those ex-managers and have a super successful game, or is it more altruistic?
Yeah, I think that one of the things about being lucky enough to be successful is that you realize that it's kind of a crapshoot. A lot of times it's kind of luck and timing and all sorts of different factors that lead to it. So trying to replicate that again is a fool's errand, right? You know, and so just trying to make something decent that people enjoy and taking it one step at a time is all that I'm really asking for. I can never really imagine having that big of a, you know, a Diablo 2 sized impact on anything. Plus, the game industry's just changed so much. There's so much content. There's so many different unique games out there now and different experiences that, like, trying to stand out or trying to do something that's was revolutionary at the time is so much harder just because the competition is so much greater.
So then you end up at Gazillion, mm-hmm. and you get to make Diablo with superheroes.
Yeah, sort of, but yes, that's right.
Marvel Heroes.
Yes.
You know, that's a game that, I don't know, maybe quietly just turned into a pretty big deal and ended up, you know, very good in the end. And did they sell you on that? Like, hey, David, come on in and we, you know.
I mean, no, not really. So after Flagship, you know, went away, went out of business. I went and worked at Turbine for about six
That's right,
months.
Yeah,
and I helped work
Seattle
on
there,
DDO.
Right?
No,
or they had another office.
Yeah, they're out in Massachusetts, and so they said, you know, we're doing free-to-play things, and we're going to get the Marvel license. We know that you're a big Marvel fan. How do you feel about this, making a Marvel MMO? I'm like, oh, my God, I would love to do that. In the meantime, we're working on Lord of the Rings and Dungeons & Dragons Online. We're going to try and make them free-to-play and stuff. So having your free-to-play expertise coming in and working on these things, it would be great to help out. So I kind of came in and helped work on doing that stuff. And then about 6 months in, they said, so about that Marvel license, we didn't get it. So we don't really have a project for you. How do you feel about moving to Boston? That doesn't sound all that appealing to me. I like San Francisco. I'm going to stay here. And then the people that did get it were Gazillion. They weren't Gazillion at the time. That name came out afterwards. But the they called me up and said, so we got the Marvel license. We hear that you're a big Marvel fan and want to do a Marvel game. So I said, yeah, absolutely. So I went over and became the creative director on Marvel Heroes. So I signed up to be, you know, I was kind of sick of being the boss. I'd been president of Blizzard North. Yeah. I had been CBO of Flagship, and I was like, you know, I don't want to do businessy types of things anymore. I want to get back to being creative. I want to be the creative director of this project.
And you found that to be a healthier experience, maybe then? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. That lasted about 10 minutes, and then you know, we started doing the different. They had a bunch of different projects going on, and. This is, you know, John Romero was working there, and he was working on a project, and so we had like all of these different. There were a bunch of different games, and I noticed that they were kind of a few of the projects needed some help, and so I started talking to the management. And the management, they weren't video game people; they were business people. You know, one person was from, you know, a biz dev person from Leapfrog. The other, you know, was basically. Lots of venture capital and had lots of connections, like that Harvard guy, MBA. You know, they were, there's some problems, there's technical problems with some of these things and whatnot. And I kind of mentioned this stuff and they said, well, why don't you be in charge of these things? and I'm like, well, you know, this process kind of dragged on for a little while. And we were like building this team. I'm convincing people to kind of like come work on my project and stuff. And so people are leaving their jobs and coming over. And then I see, oh my God, the company has some problems. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll do this job to try and make sure that the people that I've convinced to come work with me still have a job.
Yeah.
And I want to see this project through. So yeah, I'll go help out. And then I kept getting promoted, and eventually I became CEO of the company. So I got further and further away from development, you know, and became the boss again. So I don't know. It seemed like that keeps happening to me.
Well, and until you left there eventually, and after bouncing around a little bit, you seem to have now simplified things about as far as they can possibly be simplified. Your studio is Greybeard Games, and it is you.
That's
it
correct.
It is just you.
Yeah. All three employees, me, myself, and I.
Yeah. And your game is called It Lurks Below. We actually have a couple of screens behind over your
Fantastic.
Left shoulder
Fantastic.
And over your sort of in the middle of our
yep.
frame there as well. So it is before I ask you about that game, is it a relief now to of just after years of heading up these huge teams and huge companies to just have no one to worry about but yourself?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that, you know, being CEO of this company, my job was largely a finance job, right? You know, I'm going around, I'm making PowerPoints and presentations and talking to investors and, like, doing these kind of things where I spend a few minutes, you know, of my time working on design for the games or whatever, but a large portion of the job is running the business.
Sure.
And so when I was a kid, I didn't grow up and say, someday I want to be CEO. I said, someday I want to make video games. And so I was getting further and further away from doing the thing that I want to do with my life, right? And so after a while, it was just like, okay, I've done this for a little while. Marvel Heroes came out. It wasn't very successful at first. We worked really hard. We changed the game. We patched all the time. There was a lot of communication with the public, and we were very responsive to things. I would play the game, stream it on Twitch, you know, work with the community to make the game better and better and better. And I felt like that was we really kind of accomplished that
Absolutely.
Mission. And we took the game from Metacritic of, you know, 56 or something, like, into the 80s.
Yeah,
and so,
Omega and...
Yeah, exactly. And so it just became bigger and better and better and better. And after a while, I was like, okay, I feel like I've accomplished my mission here. I've saved some jobs. I'm ready to be, you know, selfish and step away from doing the job that I've been doing to get back to doing what I really want to do, which is make games. And I went extreme.
Yeah, one person outfit, It Lurks Below. So the paper version, I haven't seen, as we sit here today, you announced it publicly yesterday as we sit here. I haven't seen the game yet. You're streaming it tonight, which will have long since happened by the time anybody sees this interview. So give me the elevator pitch. Sounds awesome. Tell me about It Lurks Below.
Well, so after I left Gazillion, I spent some time. Oh, what am I going to do? I the world is my oyster now. What am I going to make? And so I started designing some stuff. And as I designed it, started making it, I started coding it, it started to come together. And it was like I had this kind of idea from the beginning. And I got about 4 or 5 months into making that, and I was like, oh my God, it's going to take me 10 years to make this game. You know, because everything I had designed had been for teams of 20, 30 plus people, you know, and lately 100 people. And going from that to a small team, I mean, I was thinking, well, I'll hire a couple people or whatever, but I was like, even with a couple people, this is going to take forever to make, right? You know, so I can't do this. So I'm going to put this idea and I'll put a pin in this idea because it's going to be, I think it's a great idea, but it's just not, we'll work on that later. And then what am I going to do next? I got to do something simple and kind of fun or whatever. Well, maybe I'll make a phone game. So I started working on a phone game. And after about 5 or 6 months, it was nearly done. I started talking to all my friends who were in the mobile business. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm not going to make any money. okay, scrap that. Let's go back to the original idea and ultra simplify it so that I could do it by myself. If I could do it by myself, you know, what would it take out of the original idea to kind of like, first we're scrapping 3D. It's not got to be, it can't be 3D, but I can go 2D and then do it, you know, I can draw the simplified sprites and all of these kind of things. And I don't really know what my motivation is for doing the project by myself. It's just something that is a challenge to myself, and I really wanted to do it. And, you know, luckily I'm in a position where I can afford to do this. And so it was let's give this a try and give it a chance and see what happens. And so I took that original idea, which was kind of like almost a Minecraft Hellgate kind of idea, and put it in kind of on the side and made this 2D sprite-based. It's kind of 2D. The background is all 3D. Huh. So the blocks are all kind of 3D, but all the sprites and stuff are all 2D artwork. And so I'm doing the art and the music and the programming and the design and everything, and I'm having a blast. I haven't been this enthusiastic about working on something in a while. I'm up. I can barely sleep. I'm so excited about like getting up and coding and working on it. So I've been kind of a nervous wreck this week, showing my baby off to the world. But so far, it's been pretty positive response.
So how do we get our hands on it? Is there a public beta or some sort of way for the public to get their hands on it anytime soon?
There isn't a way in the immediate future, but I am going to be running a public beta in the future, but not right now. I'm doing a small closed beta right now this weekend, but obviously it'll have already passed. And streaming it on Twitch, and in fact, people are streaming it on Twitch right now, and there's a small group of people that I've got that signed up, and I was able to get them some keys and things like that. In fact, I can get you keys, so don't.
We'll have coverage on IGN. Don't worry about that.
And so we'll be able to experience kind of the very minuscule part of the game or whatever. There's a lot more content and stuff that's in the game, but it's probably about 6 to 8 hours of the game or so.
Nice. And so how? Yeah, you're talking about the mobile phone thing was taking 6 months, and then you're like, let's not do that anymore. So what's the roadmap for this? How long do you think you're going to work on it, and what's the end game of It Lurks Below look like for you?
Well, I started working on it in December a year ago, so December 2016.
Yeah.
So it's just over a year now, a year and a couple months. I started, from scratch, made my own engine, my own tools, everything, because I'm a grumpy old programmer and who doesn't like new fandangled, easy-to-use languages. I learned how to program. I mainly programmed assembly language my entire career, so the fact that I'm using C is just way, way easier than the way it used to be. I started working on it, and I've done all the art and the sound and things like that. So I'm really excited about the way it's going, and it's gone really fast, mainly because I feel like I work on it all the time. Maybe I do, but my wife probably tells me that I work on it all the time. Dave's constantly working. It's gone pretty quickly, which has been great.
Have you taken a vacation in the last 14 months?
I did.
Good, I took
a vacation. In fact, it was my very... I've taken two vacations. I haven't taken a vacation in 20 years, but
wow.
I took two vacations. I took a vacation right after I kind of left Gazillion, a couple months after. After that, I went to Scotland. I like whiskey, and so I went on a whiskey tour, and that was really fun. And then I took my kids to Disney World last year, so that was my one big vacation. They loved it. It was awesome.
So before I let you go, you have such a unique perspective, having been everywhere from a one man outfit to the top of a monolithic pyramid. I mean, independent game development now is so much easier than ever before in terms of the democratization of the tools, even though. You're making your own tools, but Unreal Engine and Unity and CryEngine and all this stuff is out there, and there's all these platforms to self-publish on, whether it's app stores or Steam or ID to Xbox, all these things. But the flip side to that is it's harder than ever to get your game noticed,
right?
Because there's so many games at any given moment. I think there was a statistic like 40, I don't know, whatever, some large percentage of games on Steam total came out like last year.
Right.
Like something insane like that. So how do you kind of feel about the current state of the games industry overall as someone who's worked everything from AAA to now, the one-person outfit with It Lurks Below?
So, it's a strange time in the video game industry. In a lot of ways, it's amazing. In a lot of ways, it's nearly impossible. I think that with the advent of all these tools and all of the people's ability to kind of like get a couple people together to make a game, especially if you're young and you don't have a lot of bills to pay and things like that, or a lot of responsibilities yet, it's an easy kind of thing to do. And with your ability to do digital distribution and all of this kind of stuff and all of these advantages that you have now means a lot of people are going to do it. And there are now, I think there's approximately, I don't know the exact stat, but it's something like 40 games a day on Steam. There are hundreds of games a day on the iOS store. And it's because everybody can make games now, right? And there are so many people that they, when I was started in the industry and when I started making games, like almost nobody played games. It was extremely nerdy. I mean, I was not popular in high school. I was the kind of nerd. It was just like this little niche weird hobby or whatever. And so it's just blown up to be so huge that it's just a different thing. Now everybody is playing video games. It's a giant industry. And because of that, it feels a little bit like almost like writing books, you know, and the book is, there's so many books, there's so many people that want to write books and authors, it's really hard to kind of get noticed unless, you know, I've been in a fortunate position, so it may be, and I can't give a complete perspective on this, but I think that there's just tons of competition now, and in ways that makes it good and it makes it bad. There's a lot more terrible stories. And then you get a lot of creativity out of it, too. You get a lot of unique things, that new gameplay styles and stuff that where people can take these risks because they're small budget and small teams, and they can think of doing almost anything you can think of at this point. And you're getting different styles of games than you ever had before. Oh, I want to be, you know, whatever it is, or I'm going to take this journey to a mountain, or you know, whatever it is that never would have existed before.
Right.
And so opening the doors to these new types of games and new types of experiences is really exciting. But at the same time, there's just tons of noise, and it's really hard to wade through all of that.
So what's this? Does David Brevik have a solution to this problem?
No, there is no solution.
There is no solution.
Unfortunately, there's no solution. The fact is that I don't see anything changing, right?
Is it good or bad for the industry overall, do you feel?
It's both. I think that, yeah, because you'll end up in a situation where somebody created something great and won't get noticed. Nobody sees it. Nobody knows about it. Then, so it becomes much more of almost a luck-based kind of scenario. It's like, did you capture the right thing at the right time to get any kind of attention at all? And with the media, you know, it's like there's just wave after wave after wave of whatever kind of media is out there, whatever, it's from TV to books, to movies, to video games. You're constantly, look at all this entertainment. It's impossible to consume it all. And so stuff is that it's perfectly great is going to fall by the wayside, and that's sad. But at the same time, you're going to get cool experiences, you're going to get new types of games, and you're going to go places that you never thought you could go before.
Places like It Lurks Below.
Well, hopefully we'll see.
Keeping our eye on. David Brevik, creator of Diablo, Marvel Heroes, and now It Lurks Below. Thank you so much for joining me. This was a real treat for me. For more from the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry, please look for new episodes of IGN Unfiltered each and every month on YouTube, on IGN, or on your favorite podcast service as well.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.